call it, hour being 12:30, I will call the meeting to order. Right now we have with us Meredith Ferguson, Office of Higher Education, who's going to run through statewide longitudinal education data system. And I'm assuming we'll have a few more folks gathering us soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand you want the short version today?
That would be great. We do have quite a loaded agenda today.
Okay.
Also, a quick point. I just want to also let members and folks in the audience know that we will not be taking an actual vote on the bill today that's being presented. It's going to be a hearing, so I just want to give a heads up on that. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just for reference, this PowerPoint is actually in your packet from 2 weeks ago, dated March 18th, 2013. And it includes the full PowerPoint. We'll only be going through the first portion today. But it does include some preliminary data and analysis that we pulled out of the SLEDS data system. So for the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm a policy analyst at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Part of my responsibilities is to coordinate the higher education portion of the statewide longitudinal education data system. So SLEDS, as we affectionately call it, it has been in the works for a number of years. In fact, we received federal support for the system in 2009 through a grant from the U.S. Department of Education to the Minnesota, from the U.S. Department of Education to the Minnesota Department of Education. Of that grant, about $4 million of it went specifically to connect P20 data systems. So linking data from preschool through K-12 to higher education and into the workforce. That grant officially ends this June 30th of 2013. The goal of SLEDS is to assist in identifying the most viable pathways for individuals in achieving successful outcomes in education and work. We purposely do not define the word success. We believe that success has many meanings based on which program you're in or which point in your life you may be in. And so whether that means higher wages or degree completion, we leave that flexible to the program analysis that's being done. SLEDS does enable the state to identify predictors of long-term student and worker success, design targeted improvement strategies, improve data-driven decision-making, and to meet our federal funding requirements. By accepting federal stimulus funds in 2009, Minnesota was required to build a P20 data system. So what's been done so far? Officially, we convened the SLEDS data system in 2009 following receipt of our federal grant. SLEDS is actually under the governance of the Minnesota P20 Education Partnership. So that is a group of about 40 members representing all sorts of organizations as well as legislative members, including like Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, preschool programs, workforce programs, as well as the Department of Education, OHE, MinSCU, the University of Minnesota, and our private colleges. SLEDS operates under three structures. We have an advisory board called the SLEDS Governance Committee, and then two working groups, one on research and one on data. One that helps design the SLEDS kind of statewide research agenda, and then one that helps with technical specifications to the data system. In addition, we've been receiving some federal technical assistance for the system from the U.S. Department of Ed. So what is SLEDS? SLEDS is the alignment of data systems that are already being collected by state agencies. So from the Department of Education, we contain data on K-12 enrollment, K-12 assessment, the ACT, meaning the Explore Plan and College Entrance Exam, advanced placement results, adult basic education, kindergarten readiness, early childhood enrollment, and career and technical education. Those data sets are merged with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education data sets, including post-secondary enrollment, post-secondary completions, and characteristics of our colleges in Minnesota. In addition, the Department of Employment and Economic Development adds unemployment insurance wage detail records, those quarterly records on hours worked and wages paid to workers in Minnesota, as well as industry-level detail on employers, workforce training participant data, and ideally we'll be adding unemployment insurance benefit recipient data. In addition, we purchase data from GED, as well as from the National Student Clearinghouse on those individuals who go out of state to college. What you see before you in bold are the list of data sets that are currently in the statewide longitudinal data system. In italics are those that will be coming in shortly, and then the ones that are neither bold nor italics are the ones we have planned for future design. In terms of the questions we can answer with the system, we did a series of kind of focus groups and just stakeholder feedback meetings to kind of identify what the main questions are for coming out of a P20 data system. And the questions were actually very similar regardless of which kind of area of education and workforce you were in. And what we've kind of delineated those down to what we call the four P's. Ideally, the research will focus on pathways. What is the movement of individuals between school and work, as well as within institutions, between institutions, or between K-12 and higher education? In addition, what about the progress of those individuals? How many meet certain transition points or benchmarks along their way, or how many fail to meet those benchmarks? In addition, what are the predictors? So what are the characteristics, patterns, or commonalities that can help explain why some students successfully transition or complete and what students do not? And finally, performance. How well overall are our preschool, K-12, and higher education and workforce systems aligned? And are there ways we can improve that alignment? So everybody seemed to have a variation on those types of questions when we gathered data for the questions. So what I'd like to just do briefly now is share you some kind of our preliminary research coming out of SLED. So this is one of our first charts. This is looking at high school, Minnesota Public High School graduates from 2003 through 2011 and simply asking the question, did they go to college and if so, when? What you see before you with the 2003 cohort on the far right, the red represents those students who went on to college immediately in the fall after high school graduation. So approximately 62% of Minnesota students in the class of 2003 went to college right after high school. The green represents those who didn't go in the fall but went in the spring. Purple represents those who didn't go in the first year but went in the second. And blue are those who didn't go the first 2 years but had enrolled in post-secondary education by age 25. And as you can see, as we move forward to the class of 2011, the class of 2011 close to 70% of Minnesota high school graduates enroll in college immediately after high school. And this can be any level of post-secondary education, a short-term technical program, or a four-year degree. All of those variations are included in here. By the time the class of 2011 reaches age 25, we expect that number to be more than 80% of Minnesota high school graduates will have completed some form, or will have enrolled in some form of post-secondary education. So it's a very high number compared to other states. In addition, we looked at what kinds of colleges those students were enrolling in. The number one school for high school graduates immediately after graduation is the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Approximately 5% of high school graduates go there. In addition, the other top 10 schools represent a mix of both two-year public colleges as well as some out-of-state institutions, North Dakota State and the University of North Dakota, as well as, of course, our state universities. Number 11 on this list would have been the University of St. Thomas, so our private colleges also play a big role in enrollments of high school graduates. The interesting thing is while this list represents the destination colleges for the class of 2011, this list has not changed over the past 10 years. They may switch rankings, but the top 10 institutions have been predominant for each class of high school graduates. The last kind of analysis I'd like to share with you is about college completion. We're not only interested in whether students go to college, but whether they actually finish a degree. So using the National Student Clearinghouse data for the class of 2003, we tracked where they went for the 8 years following high school graduation. Approximately 56,000 public high school graduates were queried from the class of 2003. 35,000 of those enrolled in college in the first year after high school. That means just under 21,000 students did not go to college. Of those, 454 students finished a degree or certificate within the first 12 months after high school graduation. When we take that out of second year, we had 4,500 students drop out of higher education in their first year after high school. In addition, of those who did not enroll, 2,700 became new enrollees. In addition, we had an additional 1,876 students finish a degree or certificate in their second year following high school graduation. So if we take this analysis and fast forward to age 25, this is what you get. You get a schematic of what is the post-secondary activity of Minnesota high school graduates from the class of 2003. And if you look at the far right in the purple, you can see that we do have about 13,841 students who never enroll in post-secondary education. In addition, we have approximately 12,000 students who drop out without completing a degree or certificate. If you look at the boxes across the top, you can see most students finish a degree or certificate in that year four, 10,153. In summary, what we know of the class of 2003 is that 62.5% of them went to college immediately after high school in the fall, and 26% finished a degree or certificate within 4 years. But by age 25, 75% had enrolled, and 48% had finished a degree or certificate. 21% were no longer enrolled and did not graduate, and 4% were still in post-secondary education at age 25. 25% never enrolled. And we know, based on just the entering statistics for the class of 2011, that these numbers have improved since then. We have a much higher percentage of students who do enroll in post-secondary. So we are optimistic that our graduation rates will also show us improvements as well. The rest of the PowerPoint is more about just some preliminary reports we're doing for school districts as well as schools on looking at some of the pre-graduation, post-graduation information, providing that value-added reporting back for both students and parents as well as administrators on what the post-secondary activity of graduates are, and some college to workforce transitions. Specifically, we looked at, for example, employment rates for the class of 2010 who graduated from college. What percentage of those were employed in Minnesota 1 year after college graduation? And we looked at those not only by sector, as shown in the chart on the screen, which is slide 22, but we looked at it by degree level, which is slide 23. And we also looked at it by location, whether they were in Greater Minnesota or the Twin Cities.
Push pause. We do have one question, Representative Brainerd.
I didn't mean to have you interrupt, Ms. Fergus, Mr. Chair, but I have two questions for you, Ms. Fergus. One relates to when the transition occurred between the Department of Education and the Office of Higher Education in terms of managing this system. And then the other is, remind us what the budget line item is to support this system, you know, in the coming biennium.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Brenner. The transition from MD to OET has actually not occurred. The transition began as discussions between the commissioners of the three agencies in determining what is the best location for the state data system. MD has a new federal grant for the Early Childhood Longitudinal Education Data System, and DEED has the Workforce Data Quality Initiative Data System, and so OET stepped up and assumed a leadership role for the SLED system. Given that the focus is largely transitions from preschool to K-12 to higher ed, and then from higher ed to workforce. So it was a communal discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just from the K-12 side, I know that there's a whole range of proposals of potential data challenges and connections to be, links to be made at the K-12 level. And so what I'm wondering about is the vision from OE, from the Office of Higher Ed, that whoever manages this will continue to link to those systems, or will there be managers in all those systems? Because the uses, I mean, you're talking about the transitions, but within each of those systems, there's a whole range of data that we hope to milk out of a SLED system to help us make better policy decisions around assessment and, remediation and so forth.
Correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Brenner. We actually have a coordinator for each portion of the system. So there is an MDE staff who is charged with coordinating any K-12 issues that may arise. I am the staff in charge of coordinating higher education issues, and then there's a staff in charge of coordinating workforce issues. We meet at least every couple of weeks to talk about those issues and how we can resolve them across state agencies. If it's a specific sector question, for example, how data is presented to principals and superintendents, or what the report and feedback should be, what the report view should be like, should it be placed on the MD website through the analytics server that schools already have access to. We discuss those as a group, and then we also may inquire feedback from, like, the Minnesota School Board Association or the Minnesota Secondary School Principals Association. We've reached out to a lot of stakeholder groups on those. So, yeah, it's kind of a give and take.
One last question, Mr. Chair. When you give us the amount and the line item, does that fully cover all the functions you're talking about in terms of the collaboration among systems, or is that just for the Office of Higher Education's responsibility in relation to the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brennan, I actually can't find my copy of the appropriation, so I'm going to ask Ms. Grimes if she has one handy. But the appropriation actually covers the IT costs for the system. We expect that if there are specific agency covered or agency expenses, that those are part of the agency budget. For example, the OHE research, any research and analysis that's going to be done by SLEDS is within the OHE's research budget. So that's where those costs were held. So the costs in the line item are specific to the IT costs as well as system enhancement, purchase of new data sets, if we need any sort of kind of external support for navigating our data privacy requirements, those kind of things.
Mr. Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. So the governor's recommendation for SLEDS is for a total of $882,000 each year, of which $582,000 will go to Minnesota IT. They will have the secure data environment for the data, and then $300,000 would be at OHE for the system enhancement activities. Does that answer your question?
Yes, totally. Thank you.
You have Representative Swierczynski?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of looking back at slide 22, just looking for a little bit of clarification. Yeah. Just from the point of it on actually 21 and 22, but it talks about April through June 2011, 75.2% of those graduates were employed in Minnesota. So how does that, do we have another number when it comes to graduates that would include employment outside of the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't at this time. We are working to get that data. One of the kind of initiatives that the U.S. Department of Labor is pursuing is a state data exchange of workforce data that would allow us to kind of figure out how many Minnesota College graduates are employed, such as in North Dakota, the Fargo-Moorhead area is a big draw, or Hudson, River Falls, those kind of. And so having that data is something on our desired list, and we're hoping they can make some moves in that direction for us.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just kind of a follow-up to that, I hear once in a while folks talking about unemployment under fresh graduates. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't know who is have employment outside of the state, how do we calculate unemployment under fresh graduate students?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that number is typically calculated at a national level using some national survey data that DEED may be able to pull a state rate out of, such as the current population survey. That looks at anybody who may have graduated in the last 12 months and what their occupational or employment activity is. So it does, it uses more census-type data than workforce data. In terms of if we want to look at the specific graduates we had, at which level, in which majors, which were employed and which weren't, we're moving in that direction, but we're not quite there yet. The additional data from North Dakota, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and Iowa is really our key to that. And so far, they have not signed on to the U.S. Department of Labor initiative for data sharing.
Mr. Chair, just it seems like you know, we keep talking about trying to be as agile as possible as mm-hmm. groups of higher ed and course study and offering that better fits industry and better fits business when it comes to actually putting out degrees that are actually going to advance people's potential for unemployment. And it seems to me that would be an obvious choice, an obvious direction that we need to take to at least have the data so that we can make the correct decisions on what we're offering. Because if we're offering a whole spectrum of coursework that has no chance of finding real employment within the field, it's time. I think that's a simple step that we can take and something that we should be seriously looking at in this committee. So, thanks.
Mr. Chair and Representative, if I can just add, there are some slides later that actually show employment in Minnesota by major. So if you kind of wanted to see what the distribution is like by major, some of that is due to the location of the college, such as the Fargo-Moorhead area. They may not be picked up. Some of it may be if their degree is a national type of degree, such as a PhD or someone who's in seminary school. They may move out of state simply because that's where the location of their new job is. So you have to take those factors into context. But I totally agree. We want to move in that direction. We want to move there quickly.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I came in a little late. I apologize. Just a couple clarifications. So the total budget is $882,000
in the governor's? Mr. Chair, yes, per year.
Per year, okay. Is that, Mr. Chair? Is there an increase compared to what you had before?
Mr. Chair, our current budget is zero. We are completely funded by a U.S. Department of Education grant that will end June 30th.
So this would add state money of $882,000.
Correct.
And, Mr. Chair, why is that additional $882,000 needed when we have so many other needs? You know, needs are unlimited, but and maybe I missed that in your presentation, but why is the additional money needed when you get funding from the U.S. Department of Education?
Mr. Chair, the U.S. Department of Education funding will end June 30th.
Oh.
So we truly have no funding after that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can proceed with the slides. There.
I'm actually done unless there's a specific slide or question. There are some slides 28 and 29 look at, of the 2009-2010 graduates, what their wage rates were and whether they were employed at less than full-time or full-time. About half of all graduates are employed full-time of those who find employment in Minnesota. And of those employed full-time, this is their wage rates. For certificates, they're just under $17 an hour. At the advanced level, graduate certificate, master's, and doctorate, they're between $34 and $37 an hour. So that's another analysis we did. We also included some mobility analysis in which if they graduated from a college in Greater Minnesota, did they find employment in Greater Minnesota or move to the Twin Cities and vice versa? So there's just a series of charts that you can peruse at your leisure and let me know if there are questions. But that is all I have for you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Ms. Fergus? Well, thank you. This is a lot of great information you have here. So
thank you.
That will move on to agenda item number 5. We have testimony on proposed higher education budget proposals from some student and faculty groups. I think up first we have Matt Forstein. Forstein?
It's Forstein, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Like I said, my name is Matt Forstein, and I'm an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and I study mathematics and finance. In addition to my academics, I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, so I represent students, all 70,000 students across the 5 campuses of the University of Minnesota. I really appreciate the opportunity to address you today about the work of this committee, as well as the university's biannual budget request, which I know you've all heard about. Over the past few months in this committee, you've heard a lot about the rising cost of pursuing a post-secondary degree in the state. As a result of increasing costs and dramatically declining state investments over the past decade, the University of Minnesota students have faced tuition rates that have more than doubled in the past decade. These pressures cause students to take on higher levels of debt than ever, an average that has reached nearly $30,000 in the past years, and that's one of the highest in the nation. Myself and other students are spending more time than ever working to help pay for school, and that's just one consequence of this, and that consequence is it's making us spend less time on academics, and pursuits and career-focused development and more time on worrying on paying for school and taking part-time or even full-time jobs. You all have recently heard about the University of Minnesota's 2014 and 2015 biennial budget request from President Kaler. I'm here to say that students strongly support that request, and we believe the focus areas of that request address what we believe are the most pertinent issues for students and the state of Minnesota. Namely, we think that focus should be on affordability and stopping the trend of tuition increases. In the university's budget request, this issue is manifested in the proposed undergraduate in-state tuition freeze, which would be a 0% change in tuition rates over the next 2 years for in-state undergraduates. I would strongly encourage this committee to provide funds to support that request. The university's request also contains a number of other high-priority proposals, and those include a strategic investment in research called the MnDrive proposal, which you've heard much about, as well as a proposal that would provide loan forgiveness for students in healthcare professions that work in underserved areas after graduation. And I understand with budget targets that have been set, there will be a lot of decisions that this committee will have to make about priorities. But with that in mind, I would encourage you to strongly reinvest in the University of Minnesota and higher education to keep costs contained for Minnesota students and families and help the university continue to provide world-class academics and research in the state for the years to come. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Mr. Forst? All right, we'll continue with our testimony on the budget for higher ed here. Next up, I think we have Damon Kapke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and Representatives. My name, for the record, is Damon Kapke. I'm a faculty member at Lake Superior College. I teach English. I've been in the system for about 10 years, which means I have witnessed the period of great disinvestment in higher education. I want to talk about that a little bit just from my perspective. And I should also say that I am vice president of Minnesota State College faculty. I think I omitted that. So I represent all of the faculty members within the two-year side of the MinSCU system, so the two-year community and technical colleges. I believe that government is how people come together to make decisions that reduce risk where appropriate for other people. I think we do that collectively for the common good. And in the last 10 years, I've seen risk for students ever increase. And you have to understand that students are presenting to us already a greater risk of not achieving their academic goals. They're coming with profound problems stemming from, you name it, poverty, past educational experiences, and so forth. They have often families that they're supporting, other risk factors. And when they come to us, we add additional risks. And this is really the problem. Through disinvesting in education, we've added additional risk for these students. We do that by reducing the number of counselors that we have available to help them, and by the way, to help faculty deal with students and the issues that they're going through. Through disinvesting, we have reduced the numbers of the numbers and types of courses that we offer, including those really interesting courses that draw students in and make them really interested in education and pursuing their goals. We have cut valuable programs for students, and we have increased faculty loads, which means less time that faculty are able to spend with students, less time students are able to spend one-on-one with faculty. And all of that increases the risk for students not completing. And I'm here today to ask that we stop that trend of putting the risk onto those students who really can't bear anymore, and instead take it upon ourselves, the people of Minnesota, to pay for higher education. And so we're looking for you to support the kind of budget that the chancellor's put forth his request to fund MinSCU. We don't want to see gimmicks to try to buy down tuition. We want low tuition, but we don't want that at the expense of funding higher education. The work that we do is important work as faculty. It's important for the economy. It's important for the state, the future of all of these students. And it doesn't come free. None of it is free. It takes an investment. We are ready to invest our time in rethinking how education happens in Minnesota. We are more than willing to think about changing how we use technology, improving what we do, and we all know that there are ways in which we need to improve. We're ready to do that. We want to see an investment as well, and that support from the state and the state taxpayers. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kapke. Any questions for Mr. Kapke? All right. Next on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Russ Stanton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is the faculty at the seven state universities. Mr. Chair, members, last fall when the IFO adopted its legislative goals for the session, we did so knowing that, first of all, the state faced a $1.1 billion deficit at the time, not including inflation, not including a huge school aid shift, and also cognizant of the fact that the state's commitment to higher education had slipped dramatically over the past decade, which was pushing the burden of funding higher education off of the state onto the students, and it was driving many of our students very deeply in debt. And so what we felt is that we had to keep our recommendations modest and also very sharply focused on the highest priorities and the most important things. The second thing is, first of all, in terms of the most pressing priorities, In our opinion, the highest priority or the most pressing need in Minsk-U is simply to maintain the core programs of our institutions. By that I mean the 420 existing programs that produce about 42,000 students with certificates and degrees each year. The programs that produce the most of the nurses, most of the law enforcement officers, most of the accountants, teachers, and so forth, the positions that are absolutely vital to our economy and our society. And secondly, we prioritize restraining tuition increases and thereby restraining student debt. If, you know, anyone that's put children through college knows what that's like. The central piece of our budget recommendations is that we supported a 2.5% increase in Minsk-U's total revenue, and that was, in our opinion, modest. It's about what the inflation rate has been over the last 4 years, in each of the last 4 years. And I want to make it clear, we're talking about 2.5% of the total revenue, not just the appropriation. And let me make that clear. Minsk-U's revenue is made up of two parts. First of all, there's an appropriation, which this year is about $545 million. And it's also made up of $829 million worth of tuition. And if you're going to increase 2.5% the revenue to keep pace with inflation, it's going to have to be 2.5% of the total, which is 2.5% of $1,375,000,000, which amounts to $34 million in the first year and about $68.8 million in the second year at the biennial. And we think that the state should pay all of that this biennial. If they did, we think that Minsk-U should hold tuition at current rates and not increase tuition. And if you did that, what it would mean is tuition would not go up. Students should not be, we should not be increasing student debt, and that you'd be covering inflation for the first time in many years. And we could at least start making progress to the statute that's been on the books for many, many years that says the students are supposed to pay one-third of the cost and the state's supposed to pay two-thirds of the cost. At least we'd start making progress back toward that. However, if the state cannot come up with the 2.5% of total revenue, our position would be that tuition would have to rise. For instance, if you could only come up with $77 million over the biennium, then it would have to raise 1% each year. We believe it's absolutely necessary to have a 2.5% increase in revenue because, frankly, Minsk-U has been shelled out over the last decade in terms of its funding. I passed out a spreadsheet, I don't know if it's been passed out, which shows what's been happening to funding within Minsk-U over the last number of years. And if you look, in 1999, the state appropriation to Minsk-U was $549 million. This year that we're currently in, it's $545 million. The problem is since 1999, we've had enrollment growth of about 47,000 students, full-time equivalent students during that period of time with no additional funding for them, and we've had 37.8% inflation over that period of time that went unfunded. If you look more recently, the annual appropriations to Minsk-U dropped from $665 million in fiscal year 2008, which was the start of the recession, down to $545 million. That's an 18% drop, about $120 million a year. And so how was that absorbed? Well, most of it was absorbed by the students through higher tuition. We shifted it onto the students, and as a result, they're going very deeply in debt. But the funding shortfalls have also been absorbed by cutting state programs, cutting educational programs, cutting sections, increasing student-faculty ratios quite substantially, and also less competitive compensation. And I want to point out that less competitive compensation is an important issue. We recruit nationally for faculty all over the nation. And when right now our funding, our faculty have had, we're currently in our fourth year of a pay freeze. Our faculty salaries are now below average, and compared to comparable institutions across the state. And what that means in a free marketplace is that when we go out to hire, when our faculty departments go out to try to hire new faculty, the market is already 50% picked over by better paying institutions. That is not a good place to be in terms of quality. That's not a good place to be in terms of student quality of programs for students. We did not propose any new initiatives in our proposal in terms of funding. We felt that maintaining the quality of our existing programs should come first. These are the programs that do produce the 42,000 degrees and certificates each year. And we felt that if new initiatives are really important, they need to compete with the existing programs. What we need to do is reallocate money from existing programs to cover the new initiatives. For that reason, we do support Minsky's proposal to reallocate $44 million by consolidating back office operations, et cetera. Mr. Chair, I've been attending your hearings for the last several months, and there's a couple of issues I do think I would like to address that have come up at those hearings. First of all, we really appreciate Governor Dayton's proposals for higher education. This is the first time I can remember, I've been around here 40 years in one capacity or another, first time I can remember when higher education was got the biggest percentage increase of any sector of the budget. However, we think that the distribution of those funds between the systems, the $80 million to U of M, $80 million to Minsky, $80 million to the Office of Higher Education, is balanced only in the most political sense of the word. It does not take into account the size of the systems. The Minsky institutions have more enrollment than all the rest of the systems put together. It does not take into account the budget base that you're adding that $80 million to. And so, for instance, $80 million added to the OHE budget is a 23% increase. $80 million to Minsky in the U of M is a 7.3% increase. And we think that that could be more balanced. Also, the proposed tuition recognition grant, the tuition recognition cap, is being increased 28% in the OHE proposal. But not one penny of that increase will go to a state university student because they're under the cap already, and very few, only a handful of technical programs at the most expensive schools will receive any additional money. That proposal all by itself is nearly $70 million in the biennium, and not a penny of it goes to a state university student. And we think that, first of all, the increase is excessive, and we don't think that the proposal is balanced. I did hear that the Office of Higher Education said that in totality, the changes to the state grant program help every student, every recipient of financial aid. And they gave an average. But what that average disguises is that it's unevenly distributed. The average increase per year under the total proposals put together is about $37 per year for a state university student, and it's about $900 and some for a University of Minnesota student. And so we hope that you'll take a look at that. We do support OHE's proposals for increasing the LME. When you increase the LME, every single student gets an equal dollar increase in their grant, and by definition, it's equally proportioned between the systems. We also support the Minsky proposal to try to do more for our part-time students. I hear constantly that from faculty that these students, they're tired when they come to class, they're trying to balance family responsibilities, they're trying to balance work responsibilities and school responsibilities. It's affecting their performance, it's affecting their completion time. For some, it affects whether they complete at all. And anything you can do to help them would be appreciated. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to try to cut this short, except to say, you know, I came here 40 years ago as a freshman legislator and served in the Higher Ed Policy Committee. And what I see happening to higher education in the recent decades just makes me want to cry. I mean, we used to, you know, up until the 1980s, 80% of the cost of instruction was picked up by the state. The students paid the other 20%. In fact, vocational schools were free in the 1970s. Now, the state pays about 40%. The students pay about 60% of the cost. We used to rank near the top in terms of per capita funding of higher education. Now we're 23rd. We're not only behind North Dakota, which is second, and Iowa, which is fourth, and Wisconsin, which is 13th. We're behind Mississippi. We're behind Alabama. We're behind Kentucky, states that we used to kind of look down our nose at. And I got my most recent, that you should have in your packet from a few weeks ago, my most recent copy of post-secondary opportunity. And if you look at this, per capita funding per $1,000, or funding per $1,000 of personal income, it shows it from 1961 to present. While most states have seen a decline in the funding per $1,000 of personal income over the years, with Minnesota, it's been an absolute free fall. Since 1980, a 61.9% decline in the funding per $1,000 of personal income in the state. And there's only six states that have had worse funding. Lastly, I would like to finish by saying we not only support Governor Dayton's appropriations for funding higher education, we also support his proposals on taxation. Because when we used to be near the top at the states in terms of our funding of higher education, we didn't get there. It wasn't free. It took taxes. And the only way you're going to turn around these horrible slides in higher education funding is to back it up with the taxes to properly fund it. So with that, thank you.
One question, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of looking at your sheet of paper that you hand out, Mr. Stanton, we look at fiscal year 2012, and it says it's a projected amount of students enrollees. When we're looking at this for a year, it's 53,803 students. How has that number been? Has that projection kind of held true, or where are we sitting at?
I think that projection has held true. This year, we don't have 2013 yet because the year isn't over yet.
Okay. And then you kind of mentioned, you know, this is kind of the baseline, what we're looking at for the budget. You know, what do you perceive, you know, for an ask potentially next year when it comes to potential increases? Where do you feel like that would be needed for the, you know, potential moving out into the future?
Well, what our proposal was, 2.5% each year.
Okay.
And that's about what inflation has been worth.
Thank you. So that 2.5% rate, when we're looking at higher ed, that's kind of, you're just looking at general inflation across the economy when you're calculating that. What are you looking at just within the field of higher ed when it comes to per year increase in cost? So you're notwithstanding state subsidies, notwithstanding, what are you looking at per year growth just within the Minsky system when it comes to the actual cost of delivering education? Are you looking at 2.5%?
There is an index called the Higher Education Price Index. I don't have the number.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Okay. Thank you.
I'll try to get it.
All right. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Director Stanton. Or Stanton, right?
Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay. On the graph you have here, is that adjusted for inflation?
That is the $1,000, the higher education expenditures per $1,000 of personal
income.
Okay,
there's no inflation factor in there. Just
well, I mean, as incomes grow, you know, that should be reflected in there.
Okay. The other thing I just wanted to say is I don't want to hurt the Minsky system or the University of Minnesota. I don't think anybody on the committee does, to tell you the truth. We're in difficult financial circumstances, mm-hmm. obviously. Mm-hmm. But I could use Minsky's help in a couple of areas, okay? Because we need to generate more revenue, mm-hmm. regardless whether we want to raise taxes, reduce taxes, or grow government or whatever we want to do. We could use additional revenue. And, you know, when I look at some of the laws and regulations we have in our state, they kind of punish the three areas that can grow our revenue. You know, the production of minerals, the production of manufacturing, and the production of growing or farming. Those are the three ways that you can actually grow wealth and make the pie bigger. But we actually seem to be pursuing policies in many cases that are driving up the cost for those areas and therefore reducing their ability to expand and grow and generate more revenue. And I'll just give you a couple examples. With electricity, we've passed in the past and currently are considering laws that will drive up the cost of electricity for our businesses and families and even for our institutions. And to me, it's completely unnecessary. We should be pursuing policies that bring our electricity rates down. Also, in terms of the economics of it, we have one of the strictest regulations from an environmentalist standpoint. I would consider them to be extremist in terms of tapping into our minerals, which we're one of the richest states in the nation. I think everybody needs to know that. We've got more wealth in this station in terms of minerals than almost any other state in the country. We've got trillions of dollars, okay? And we're bottling it up, and we're not using it. So if Minsky can get behind reasonable proposals in these areas that will generate additional tax revenue, I'll be more than happy to vote for more money for you. But if we're going to go this direction of higher taxes, higher regulations, and punish these three areas, which is going to reduce produce lower tax revenues, then I'm going to have a hard time coming up with the money from families and businesses to fund those requests. So I just appreciate if you think about that. Thank you very much, Mr. Stanton. And next up we have Mr. Sabin. I just want to remind folks we will be getting to Representative Mariani's bill. I'm going to try to get to around 12:30-ish, if possible. Well, I'm sorry, 1:30. Mr. Sabin and Ms. Miles.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Chair Dorholt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Sabin, and I am president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, or MSCSA, as well as a nursing student at Central Lakes College in Brainerd. I'd first like to say thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you all today. On behalf of Minnesota's 100,000 public two-year community and technical college students, thank you for your commitment to keeping tuition down and reducing student debt. I would also like to offer MSCSA's support for the Minnesota State Colleges and University System's budget request. This proposal addresses critical challenges facing our state and seeks to leverage private partnerships in an effort to control the rising cost of higher education. Low tuition is the best form of financial aid. Minnesota public college students pay the third highest tuition and fees in the country. As a result of historic higher education cuts to Minsky over the last decade, students have carried the weight of state disinvestment in the form of skyrocketing tuition prices. In previous bienniums, MSCSA has advocated for tuition caps at the legislature to assure college remained affordable, even in the face of disinvestment. Our students felt it was necessary to cap tuition legislatively because in the past the Minsky system had not committed to tuition and fee ceilings prior to the legislative session. This biennium, however, the system's request recognizes the need to limit tuition increases. Upon his installation, Chancellor Stephen Rosenstone stated, to you, our students, I have heard you on tuition, and I get it. The chancellor's commitment to affordability and quality is evident in the Minsky budget request. This commitment to both an affordable and quality higher education is ultimately what secured the support of our students. The Minsky proposal will not raise tuition or fees more than 3% across our colleges. This request begins to put Minsky on a path towards long-term tuition control. I'd also like to speak to you on one important component of Minsky's request, this being addressing the structural inequities in the Minnesota State Grant Program that pose a barrier to part-time students. For years, Minnesota's part-time working students have been discriminated against in the state grant program. Students who work do not receive a truly prorated state grant award. Rather, part-time students receive less funding on average based on a percentage of their credit load relative to full-time students. Since 2008, the number of part-time students at Minsky institutions has increased 17.6%. The majority of Minsky's college students are now part-time. The growing number of part-time students are working to support families. That limits their debt and gains workforce retraining and are already contributing to the economy. Now is the time to help this new majority of part-time students. Prorating the assigned family responsibility will help reduce the inequity in the state grant program to benefit Minnesota students. MSCSA is acutely aware of the financial pressure our state is facing. As you know, funding higher education is an investment in our state's future prosperity. With the House budget target now set at $150 million, MSCSA encourages the committee to prioritize funding the Minsky budget request, and if there is any new spending in the state grant program, that first go to prorating the AFR to help working part-time students across all sectors. The Minsky budget proposal will help students succeed by ensuring access and affordability, will increase graduation rates, will provide students with the experience they need to land a well-paying job, and will keep Minnesota companies competitive. Supporting Minsky and aiding part-time students by prorating the AFR is imperative to the state's future success. I hope I can count on your support on our priorities. Again, thank you for your work on behalf of Minnesota students and the opportunity to address you today, and I'll stand for any questions.
See now, Ms. Miles.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Dorholt and committee members. My name is Mariah Miles, and I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I'm currently a senior at MSU Mankato, majoring in international relations. The Minnesota State University Student Association represents the seven state universities that include MSU Mankato, Minnesota State Moorhead, Winona State, Bemidji State, Southwest State, Metropolitan State, and St. Cloud State. We are an independent nonprofit organization funded and operated by students. We currently serve more than 75,000 students. MSUSA is excited to continue our work this session with this committee and the rest of the state legislature to address the challenges facing our students. Today, I'm here to address the Minsky request. Our students are particularly excited about this request and are working hard with Minsky to see it through. We did not come to this conclusion without very thorough discussion on our campuses and as a statewide association. In November, our association gathered more than 75 elected student leaders and debated this proposal for many hours. We're excited about the Chancellor's new vision and are supportive of the Board of Trustees' vision for a system that focuses on student success and preparedness. Our students do not take the proposed tuition increases lightly. We have seen the effects of reductions on campuses firsthand and as the legislature decimated higher education funding. We also understand that there is still a budget deficit. Our students believe this request is the first right step in the right direction, reversing the trend over the last decade. It makes investments in needed quality measures while also working to keep tuition increases at a minimum. There are many initiatives included in the budget proposal that directly help students enhance their educational experiences. One initiative that our students are fiercely excited about is a proposal to match state dollars with private investment to create 10,000 new internships by 2015. Internships are vital to student success and allow them to further their education in the workplace. They greatly enhance the opportunities afforded to students and to the communities across the state that a Minsky College or university serve. Without internships, opportunities many students will not be able to build relationships, gain the experience necessary to secure a job as they finish their degree. If the state is willing to match private investment and create a stipend program, this will allow students to invest time that is necessary to get the full breadth offered by an internship in their prospective field, rather than spend their time working for minimum wage at Jiffy Lube, Quick Trip, or Subway. The second piece of the Minsky proposal is that our students are in need investment in the Leveraged Equipment Fund. Many of our universities are training students on equipment that is out of date. For example, at Winona State, there is a need in both engineering and nursing departments. At Mankato, we need investments in the clinical science department that offers free or low-cost health services in dental hygiene, rehab counseling, speech-language pathology, and audiology. We also have a need in our College of Science, Engineering, and Technology for equipment in areas like renewable energies. There is no doubt that the continued cuts to our campuses over the last decade have hurt our university's ability to aptly provide a quality education, and this is one investment that we need to get our system back to the level that students and employers expect. This initiative, similar to the internship goal, will also be matched by private investment. Another part of both the internship and leverage equipment program we like is that the money is not being spent by the central office. There is no mandate on how the internship programs must work or where the greatest need for leverage equipment investments on each campus. Those decisions are left up to our campuses to decide, because an internship program that will work at Winona will most likely not work at Moorhead. The local autonomy will allow these programs to excel at each individual campus. As a student at Mankato, I appreciate this facet of the proposal and see the need for this funding on a daily basis. I've already been approached by community businesses and faculties about these opportunities. I can tell you this week I've gotten emails about these opportunities still, and I'm actually becoming a little pestered by the businesses, but it's a great pester to have, and I hope to see this through. The final piece of the Minsky proposal that students support is the investment in our faculty. Our faculty have been saddled with a pay freeze for 4 consecutive years. Without quality faculty, the $30,000 in debt we're graduating with on average is not worth the investment. We need to support the retention and recruitment of high-quality faculty. I'm sure many of you have figured out as you have moved through your various careers, it is not simply the business or institution that produces success. It is the talented people, the motivated staff, and the eager customer that have produced great results. We have every part of that recipe at our universities. We just need your support to make these dreams and opportunities come true. I want to end by saying thank you to the committee for the hard work you do, and say that students know how badly you want to help. We are also very appreciative of the governor's proposal, and we hope to see that through to make sure it reaches our students in the best way possible. We really do appreciate your time and energy you put into this process, and I'll stand for any questions.
Do you have any questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation, for your hard work.
Thank you.
We'll now move on with Representative Mariani. We have one more testifier on the budget. Paul Cirkvenik, and then Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cirkvenik. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I have some slides, and I have a little technical help here getting those up on the board. I understand you have a bill, so I'm going to try to breeze through the first few slides and spend a little more time on the last few. Thank you. I want to try to do 3 things in my testimony. Give you a little sense of the role private nonprofit colleges play in higher education in Minnesota, address questions of tuition and debt at our colleges, and speak to the importance of the state grant program and our views on how to best invest dollars in that program. Our 17-member institutions are all private, nonprofit, charitable institutions. They have a core commitment to a liberal arts education, and they all have missions that serve a fundamentally public purpose, which I would summarize as providing high-quality educational opportunities that prepare students for professional and personal success and for service and leadership in their communities. As you know, our colleges receive no direct state appropriations, either for operating support or capital funding. Only a small share, about 2.7% of the total current state higher education budget, impacts our institutions through financial aid which our students are eligible to receive. Now I'm going to skip, I'm going to go really quickly through this next five or six slides in light of the time. We enroll about 58,000 students this past year, which is nearly as big as the University of Minnesota system or the four-year enrollment in the MinSCU system. 43,000 of our students are undergrads, and 72% of those students are Minnesota residents. We also attract students from around the nation because of the high quality opportunities at our school. We provide we grant about 28% of the bachelor's degrees every year in Minnesota, including a much higher share of degrees in fields that are of critical importance to the economic strength of the state, fields such as the physical sciences, chemistry, physics, mathematics, statistics, four-year nursing degrees, and so on. Our colleges are committed to serving students from all walks of life, and as a result, our student population really reflects Minnesota. One out of four students at our schools come from families with $50,000 or less in income, which is about the same as the enrollment in public institutions in Minnesota. One in five of our students are first-generation students, and 27% of our students have incomes low enough to qualify for a Pell Grant. We have a significant share of transfer students, including transfers from the two-year and four-year public institutions in Minnesota. And 14% of our students are non-traditional undergraduates, meaning they're 25 years or older. And six of our colleges offer specialized weekend, evening, and online degree completion programs aimed at non-traditional students. Finally, our schools are diverse. 18% of our first-year students in fall of 2011 were students of color. And since 2002, our enrollment of white students has declined 2%, while our enrollment of students of color has increased 104%. Finally, our graduation rates are not only the highest in Minnesota and the Midwest, but among the tops in the nation. If you look only at private colleges, on a state-by-state basis, the average graduation of MPC graduation rate of Minnesota Private College Council schools ranks fifth nationally. Now let me say a couple things about affordability and debt. As this graph shows, published tuitions at our colleges have risen at about 6% per year over the last decade. But at the same time, our colleges have increased institutionally funded aid by 11% per year. Now, in order to sustain that 11% annual increase in financial aid spending at our colleges, our institutions have had to really aggressively restrain the spending in all other areas of their budgets. They've been through salary freezes, staff reductions, program eliminations, all in order to increase the resources they direct towards financial aid. Institutionally funded financial aid, not state and federal aid. The result is that net tuition, the amount of tuition students actually pay at our colleges, has actually increased at about 3% per year over the last decade on average. And even more importantly, when you look at tuition over the last 5 to 7 years at our schools, you see the effect of their sustained commitment to providing financial aid themselves. Net tuition at our schools has essentially been flat since 2007. And when adjusted for inflation, regular CPI inflation, net tuition today is about the same as it was in 2003. Finally, let me talk about debt for a minute. Debt is obviously an increasing challenge for all students at all institutions. And rising tuitions are a contributing factor to rising student debt. But so are other factors, including stagnant and falling family incomes an underinvestment in federal and state support for financial aid programs. Our average student debt levels are not significantly different than our public institution counterparts, even though our students do not benefit from state appropriations that significantly reduce tuition for all students at public institutions. Now, if I could switch to the state grant program, let me start by pointing out that in the last few years, students served by the state grant program have faced declining family incomes. The recession's effect on lower and middle income families and their ability to pay for college has been dramatic. In the 3 years from 2009 to 2011, the number of state grant recipients who qualified for the maximum grant increased 66%. Over time, the buying power of the state and federal Pell Grant has also been declining. At our colleges, the combined maximum Pell and state grant will cover only about 30% of the average tuition. Of the entire state budget for higher education, about 11% is currently spent on need-based financial aid awarded directly to students. And only about 2.7% of all higher education spending goes to students at MPCC colleges through the state grant program. This spending on students at Minnesota's private colleges is a great value and a great investment for the state. For only 2.7% of all higher education spending, our colleges produce 28% of all the four-year degrees in the state. We deeply appreciate this investment, and our students deeply appreciate it. We want you to know that we're strongly supportive of Governor Dayton's proposal to invest an additional $80 million in the state grant program, and we agree with his priorities to increase the two-year and four-year tuition caps and to raise the living and miscellaneous expense allowance in the grant program. These proposals will help all students and will base grants for students on actual costs of attendance at public institutions. Now let me talk about raising the tuition cap for a minute. Raising the tuition caps and tying them to the maximum tuition levels at 2 and 4 year public institutions is important to ensure that financial aid grants are based on actual tuition costs, at least up to the level of public institutions. For many years, the 4 year cap was actually well above the tuition at the University of Minnesota. Now it's about $3,000 below the U of M's tuition. Within the coming biennium, the tuition at some two-year colleges is going to exceed the two-year cap. In part, this is a basic fairness issue. Over the last 6 years, students at the University of Minnesota and MPCC students have lost $113 million in grant aid they would have otherwise qualified for, but for the artificially low tuition cap. Over the last 6 years, the tuition caps did not affect MinSCU students in the same way because their tuitions were below the caps. When their tuitions increased, their grants increased in corresponding amounts to reflect those additional costs. With the freeze created by the four-year cap, choice in higher education options is being eliminated for lower and lower middle income students. Part of what's good about higher education in Minnesota is that students have a diversity of choices. If the cap is not raised, grants will be too small to give students real choice. And choice is important for lower and middle income students because a student is more likely to succeed if he or she can find the college that is the right fit for them. And choice is also important because it promotes healthy competition, competition that will drive up quality and performance and drive down costs. I want you to know that students at our colleges have real unmet need at all income levels up to nearly $100,000 of family income. When students have unmet need in their financial aid packages, they have few options. Generally, they have to increase borrowing, and often that means borrowing in the private lending market. Increasing the tuition caps in the state grant program will help meet real unmet need and reduce student debt. Finally, I want to talk about proposals to increase part-time grants. I've included a table in your package, and I think, in short, what the table demonstrates is the current grant program treats part-time students and full-time students fairly when you look at the size of their grants relative to their tuition costs. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to stop there. I'd be glad to answer questions. I do want to say that we've included with our materials an opinion column that four of our college presidents wrote, where they've indicated their belief that raising additional revenues for the purposes of supporting investments in higher education generally and the state grant program in particular are choices that make sense for the future economic and economic health and prosperity of the state. So we would ask you in your budget decisions just to devote a reasonable share of your new higher education resources to students in the state grant program. It's a way to target your limited dollars to the students who need grants the most. Thank you.
So, Representative, did you have a quick question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of looking back, I wish you could have provided us with your handout here.
I think it's in your package.
It is, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it is. But looking back, you had an average growth rate, I think, of 3%.
Right.
Historically, and I think that was an average from 2001 to 2011.
Right.
But then you also had another slide that talked a little bit about your average debt. When I think you were $31,000, the U was $29,000, and
right.
down the line.
Yeah.
Is that all? Could you provide some other numbers that maybe went back historically, rather than looking just at 2011, 2012, but look back that potentially follows that line? You know, from the, if we're talking about averages and average and an increase, you know, I have Mr. Stanton going to get some average increase per year when it comes to real cost within the public institutions. But provide some of that debt load, not just from the last year, but look at some of those comparisons looking back, and we may have some of that. But my next kind of portion goes to fiscal staff. Looking at some of those the tuition caps, if we were to kind of lift that cap and do some of those things, what would be some of those potential costs per dollar or per thousand of that cap raised? Is there any idea of what something like that would potentially cost? Because obviously when you raise the tuition cap and it can follow the grant process and what's available and the ability for a student to have that, you know, we as a state, I think we're having some fiscal benefit by keeping that low. You know, if we were to move it up as the testimony is talking about, what are we really looking at? If you have some estimates or... sorry to kind of put you on a spot there, Emily, but...
Emma. Put you on pause. In the interest of time, if you could get those answers, Representative Swierdzinski, and if you could get him some of those numbers, that'd be great. I know
Chair.
Representative Mariani has a large crew of testifiers, and I want to at least give him 15 minutes here. No problem. I definitely apologize for the jam-packed schedule for today. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will provide some historical data for the committee.
Thank you very much. And Representative Mariani.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members, and I appreciate your chair members, and I appreciate your. I chair a committee, so I understand the difficulty of moving an agenda along, but it's good to be here this morning.
And I just want to restate real quick for those of you who weren't here before. We're just going to give this a hearing today, and it will be laid over for further consideration. So for today, and we will be meeting again on Monday.
Mr. Chair, members, I will try to move as quickly as possible. There are several folks that would like to also say a few words. I think it's important that you hear from them. It is my deep privilege to bring before this committee House File 875. 875 is about expanding educational opportunity that will produce a more prosperous Minnesota for all of us. So it does two things. It expands educational opportunity that leads to more prosperity for our state. We are a people in Minnesota who believe in the power of education, a power that advances individuals and a power that makes us a stronger state. It's so powerful, members, that we have committed ourselves to making educational opportunities to Minnesota's Minnesotans available regardless of income, regardless of whether they come from rural communities or from urban poor communities, or regardless of what their race is. House File 875 continues that proud and smart tradition by including Minnesota's undocumented immigrant students in our state's student aid program and in eligibility for in-state tuition rate if they meet three conditions. One, have attended high school within Minnesota for three or more years, and two, have graduated from a Minnesota high school or attained the equivalent graduation credential, and three, have filed an affidavit that they will normalize their immigration status with the federal government. House File 875 also makes it possible for public post-secondary institutions to use private sources of funding to provide scholarships for these students without simply referring them to those opportunities outside of their own institutional processes. Our nation, members, is moving steadily to making sense and order out of our immigration issues. Meanwhile, states as politically diverse as Texas and California have already taken the steps in House File 875 in order to strengthen their own state. And to that, I would refer you to the handout on page 3 that has a nice grid of action that's happened, different action that's happened across many states. The fiscal note shows a one-time upfront cost of $100,000 for the Office of Higher Ed to establish a process to process these students. The fiscal note also estimates that about 333 students will apply, and if the state wishes to keep the average state grant at the same level, it will need to appropriate an additional $539,000 per year. That's if the state wants to keep the state grant at the same level as it is now. However, the number of students, members, that are estimated to apply is only 0.2% of students enrolled in our public post-secondary institutions. So if we don't appropriate the $539,000, the impact on the average grant will be very small in terms of lowering that prorated average grant down. It'll be very small. But nonetheless will remain a good investment on our part. And members, those 333 students averages out to about two students per campus if you divided it out by the number of institutions in our state. Members, I was here in the late 90s when the federal government, in my opinion, overstepped its bounds in order to intrude on our state and other states' right to determine resident student status for our state higher ed schools, which, after all, members, we pay for with Minnesota state taxes, not with federal taxes. House File 875 reasserts Minnesota's wisdom for how we best invest in our human capacity. In the audience today, we have young Minnesotans whose only desire is to become well-educated and to join the ranks of Minnesota's skilled workforce. These are young people whose primary desire is to become well-educated. They want to be able to give back to the state society that has provided so much to them. Their dreams will be determined by this legislative session's decisions on bills like House File 875. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to ask those individuals to come forward. We have several students, Talia Estrada, Karen Salas, and Jocelyn Hernandez, and they're going to be accompanied by Minneapolis and St. Paul administrators Effie Agbamo and Michael Thomas, and I'll ask them to join us in the back here, and I'm going to move over and make space for them.
Thank you. When you speak, you just identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a pleasure to be here today. My name is Talia Estrada. I was born in 1995. At the age of 4, my parents left the United States left my home country to begin a better life due to the fear of losing our lives. After celebrating my fifth birthday, me and my older brother were ready to fly into the U.S. And little did I know that that was going to be the last time I would see my family. I came here in 2001, and I enrolled in school 3 days after my arrival, so I began kindergarten like any other precious child who was born here. And years passed, and I started to forget my past. I learned a new language, a new culture, a new way of living. And the U.S. became my home. Minnesota became my home. It wasn't until high school till I realized what a Social Security number meant. And that's when I began to run through many closed doors. I knew my life was going to be a lot harder than others, but I wasn't going to let that stop me. I have become a very dedicated and unstoppable dreamer. I'm now a senior at Central Senior High School in St. Paul. I have done more than 40 hours of volunteer service at hospitals, helping hundreds of patients, and I have involved myself in community events. I have a GPA of a 3.5, which means I have been an honor student since my freshman year. I've also exceeded high school requirements, and I have participated in a biology course at Hamline University as a PSEO student. This all may sound very significant, and even though I have been accepted to the top universities of Minnesota, I still face the fear of how I'm going to pay my tuition, out-of-state tuition. My brother is a part-time student at Minneapolis State Technical College, and my parents still struggle to pay for his tuition every 6 months. Because I'm not eligible for financial aid, I am horrified to think about how this maybe would be the end for me. I know there are scholarships available, of course, but because of my situation, I'm only applicable for so little, which means I have to hunt for scholarships. It's frustrating to think that my GPA, my volunteer work, and everything that I have done is pushed aside just of a situation that I have no control over. I'm now speaking for the many dreamers here. And like I said before, we are not going to stop. We're going to keep fighting and look for more opportunities to help us, to help our lives just be a little bit easier. Let us be successful. Help us be successful to change lives like the opportunity that you guys have been given today. Please, we're asking you to support us. Thank you very much.
Chair, members of the committee, hello, my name is Jocelyn and I am 15 years old. I am a freshman at Robbinsdale Cooper High School. I have been taking all honors IB classes and I plan on taking the IB diploma program in my junior and senior year as well as post-secondary classes. My GPA has never been lower than a 3.5 and I've always strived to maintain excellence in all my classes. I have an unquenchable thirst for knowledge, and school has always been and still remains one of the most important aspects of my life. I was born in Mexico, but I only lived there for 11 months. All I know is Minnesota. I was still an infant when I arrived in the United States, and it was not my choice. I have many dreams, but I'm being held back because simply my legal status. Now that I'm growing up, this status is affecting me even more. The issue of college and how to pay for it has arrived. I would like to double major in sociology and criminology in college in order to find the causes of why school shootings happen, in order to make our schools much safer and better overall. These goals of mine cannot be possible without the access to financial aid and scholarships, whether they be private or public. Being able to pay in-state tuition would also make this desire of mine more attainable. My 17-year-old brother is going to start applying for college soon, and after that, I will too. Those are two, possibly four-year college tuitions that will fall on my parents' shoulders in a very small time frame. Having access to financial aid and in-state tuitions will make my dreams of going to college possible. I want to help make this country a better place, as well as the state. We Dreamers are very talented young adults who have no criminal records, and we are honor students. All we want is a chance. The United States is the only home I know. I am but only a 15-year-old girl who desires an education. Please, members, help me achieve my dream by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karim Salas, and I'm in my second year at Riverland Community College. I live in Austin, Minnesota. I have two sisters, one who's a junior in high school, and another one studying at St. Cloud State University. When I was 8 years old, I boarded an airplane not knowing what was ahead of me. I didn't know I was to leave everything I knew behind and start a new life. The minute I stepped into American soil, I was to learn a new language and make new friends and live in the shadows. As time passed, I became more and more accustomed to the American life. I started to see myself as a real American, even though I don't have the documentation. I've always worked hard to have good grades. Just like them, I also have a 3.5 GPA. My parents have always told me to excel in life. I try to volunteer as much as I possibly can, and I'm involved in a lot of different organizations like MSCSA and the AAUW. I've always believed myself to be a true American. I sing the national anthem just like everybody else, and I'm more interested about what happens in my town than anywhere else. It wasn't until I reached high school that I started to see myself differently. How could I be so different if I have the same beliefs as everyone else does in this country? There are many people in my town that believe I am going to be the future of Austin. They see the hunger and the need for higher education. They tell me I'm the future. However, even though they think I am the future of Austin, my chances of actually staying here and actually improving this town are very small. The older I get, the harder it has been for me to do a lot of things. Not being able to study, work, go to school have become huge obstacles that keep increasing as I get older. This bill is a form of myself and others to continue with our dreams. I will be graduating on May 17th from Riverland Community College with my associate degree in liberal arts. My goal is to continue on and study marketing and international relations. But at this point, I am not sure if I'll be able to continue. Currently, my dad is the only one that's paying for all the household expenses, and he's also paying for my sister's school expenses as well. Even though education is very important for me, I'm not sure if I'll be able to continue. This bill won't be just helping everybody, won't just helping me, but it will be helping everybody else. It won't cover all of my costs, but it sure definitely will give me a little help. It will allow me to pay for some of my education. It'll give me some in-state tuition to the university that I was accepted at for next year. It'll also allow me to keep going with my dreams. In-state tuition is what I most need from this bill. I was once told that equality and equity are not the same. I, like many others, always thought that equality is what we strive for. However, for education, that's not right. Equity is what this bill gives, because this bill will allow us to get the education that we want and at the place that meets all of our needs. This bill is also a tool that will not only be an investment in the future, but it will also increase high school graduation and college enrollment. There are many of us that will definitely benefit from this and will contribute our success back into our towns. Representatives, I ask that you please let us continue with our dreams, that you let me and us continue with our studies and finish them. All we ask of you is to let us honor the investment that you put in our education. Representative Poppy, you've seen how our town has grown. You know how hard we strive to be where we are right now. You've seen how the Latino community has put a lot of emphasis on growing the town. You've seen businesses grow like Alicia's Bakery, and all of us in Austin are counting on your vote. I hope today you make the right decision in the end and vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Thomas, and I'm the Associate Superintendent with the Minneapolis Public Schools. And on behalf of the 33,000 students in our district, I want to thank you for allowing this bill to come forth with this committee. And I also want to take an opportunity to thank Representative Mariani and all of his colleagues for bringing this bill to life. His leadership on this issue with others will help us close the opportunity gap and ensure that all students can succeed. A special note of appreciation for Minneapolis Public Schools goes out to all the students, families, organizers, and community leaders who have been paving the way for this initiative. Many of you are in the room today, and I want to take this opportunity to acknowledge your hard work and your courage on behalf of this bill. We are the state's third largest urban school district, and our student body is comprised of 70% students of color. 21% of our students are English language learners. Through the leadership of our superintendent, Dr. Bernadia Johnson, we supported 600 of our students to apply for deferred action. Our students are impacted directly by the bill that is being proposed to you today. Our Board of Education has established the English Learner Commission to dramatically improve academic outcomes for English learners, but we know that we cannot do this work alone. This bill will support us to achieve this goal, and it will help us to close the opportunity gap that threatens our community and the economy and our future. To fulfill this mission of ensuring that every child is college and career ready, we need laws to change. We need policies like House File 875 and its companion bill in Senate File 723 to pass. With your help, rather than being fearful of deportation, our students will be inspired to stay in school, excel in their studies, and pursue their dreams of a college education. Investing in the future of undocumented students is securing the economic future of our state and our nation. There are thousands of students that depend on our state's leadership in fulfilling every young person's American dream. And I'll close with the words of Booker T. Washington, and he states that he has learned that success in life is not to be determined by what one has attained, rather by the obstacles one has overcome while trying to succeed. We are asking that you help reduce those obstacles for our students to allow them to experience their fullest success in life. Thank you, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. We are being booted out of this room, so we will reconvene on Monday, April 8th at 12:30 in Room 5, the State Office Building. And so this will be Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I realize that we've run out of time, but I just do want to acknowledge also the presence of Ms. Effie Aclamo, who's an assistant superintendent with our St. Paul Public Schools. Also, Ms. Amy Wallstein with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, who is in support of this effort, as well as Father Howard. Joseph, I'm sorry, Father, oh boy, I got to do my penance this weekend, who's also works with a large Latino and immigrant community parish in South Minneapolis, who also is here in support of this bill. And so I appreciate your patience and going a little bit over in terms of hearing this very important issue, and I look forward to your hopefully proactive action on this as you put together your bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for and thank you everybody for coming. I apologize for the short amount of time. Representative Poppy, do you have more?
I'd like to move the minutes of March, the last minutes, March 18th.
Any objection? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Moved, and we will see you Monday.